Coming up on Boston Public Radio, just 36 days till the primaries. Are voters paying attention? Are there differences to pay attention to? We'll ask former Romneyite Charlie Chipio and former state treasurer and gubernatorial candidate Shannon O'Brien. Then it's a big day at Market Basket. Show up or be replaced. A 41-year worker will join us. Then we'll ask why political leaders and would-be leaders are treading so carefully.
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on pro-immigration religious protesters arrested at the White House, but there were only a few hundred. Then the Vatican is cracking down on that menace in the Mass, the handshake of peace. We'll debate with you, what's worse, getting germs from a firm handshake or shaking hands with a wimpy fish of a handshaker? Then Garen Daly on the changing roles of priests in film, our news hook, the new black comedy slash thriller, Calvary. All that's coming up. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So the primaries are just a month away, plus a couple days. If politicians are shopping around for votes, and they are, could they get a few more if they said something at least a little more meaningful about the Market Basket uprising? Joining us to take on this and other political headlines is Shannon O'Brien. Shannon's the former state treasurer and Democratic gubernatorial nominee. Charlie Chipio is also with us. He runs Chipio Strategies, and he worked in the Romney administration. Hello again to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you both for coming in. So as Jim said, what is it, 36 days, I think.
36 days.
It's not exactly lighting up the state of Massachusetts yet, but there is more sniping coming from State Treasurer Steve Grossman toward Attorney General Martha Coakley. They're, of course, running on the Democratic side. And then there's claims by Grossman's people that Martha Coakley is intimidating Grossman fundraisers by sending out these letters saying they're going to look into the fundraising and the sources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Does any of this matter, do you think, to the voters, or, you know, it's just kind of more hot air?
I think that it no, I don't think that it matters. I think that what happens in this part of the campaign in the summer, when people are more concerned about whether or not they've, you know, properly applied their SPF in the day, that a lot of this back and forth can sometimes be confusing, and people don't really they don't read beyond the first line or two of a story like this. So it's hard for people to digest. So that being said, I think that the fact that Martha Coakley has such a significant lead over all of her Democratic and it's looking like, you know, possibly even her Republican rival at this point in time, I think that you have to do something. And something is, how do you take down someone's positives? And I think it's not a silly strategy for the Grossman campaign. I'm just not sure that at this point in time it's going to be effective.
Can't remember. Have you endorsed anybody in the Democratic primary, Shannon?
Martha Coakley.
You have. Okay. Yeah. Charlie, before we get your response to this, the thing Marjorie's talking about, this super PAC, it's called Mass Forward.
Right.
It's operating on behalf of Steve Grossman, even though theoretically independently, and that's what Martha Coakley is suggesting may not pass the laugh test. It features mothers whose sons were killed by gun violence. Here's one such mother.
We all agree with Governor Patrick, who wants to limit gun purchases to one a month. Steve Grossman supports that, but Martha Coakley opposes it again and again. She says it wouldn't have any effect. She's wrong. One less gun can save a life.
Now, Steve Grossman, when attacked by a number of people over this, has said it's perfectly accurate. Yvonne Abraham, writing in the Boston Globe, said, talk about taking something out of context and suggesting, without saying it, that she's weak on gun control because she doesn't back this one provision. Yvonne Abraham thinks it's pretty low rent. Do you? And does it? I mean, this is a pretty emotional issue. While I generally agree with Shannon O'Brien, what you say in the summer, sadly, has virtually no impact. This is a pretty dramatic statement for those who see it.
Well, he's pretty dramatically behind, you know, and I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. Look, I mean, the reality is I think the average voter looks at this and to the degree that they pay attention, they know that both of these candidates are pro-gun control. And so, you know, it's largely a distinction without a difference. And then it gets to this whole thing about super PACs. They, for the most part, I'm sure, don't even know what a super PAC is. So, yeah, I think it kind of looks desperate. I think it has I think it has no impact.
You know, by the way, we should say, since we occasionally say unkind things about your former employer, the legislature actually passed something which will not do away with super PACs, because obviously in light of Citizens United, they can't do that, but which would require the disclosure of those who contribute to super PACs, which is now secret until after an election, within certain number of days of an ad appearing. So the theory is that people will be able to judge a little bit more about the source and maybe the content.
Again, it's not an answer. I mean, I think Citizens United has created a lot of problems all across the country in terms of big money, secret money, dark money in politics. But I think it's a good first step that the legislature took. I think at least disclosure and understanding where some of these messages are coming from. I think it's fair that voters have that information.
Absolutely. You know, I have to say, Charlie Chipio, it's kind of sad state of affairs. And Shannon O'Brien said the same thing, too. People are worried about putting on their SPF in the summertime. These poor politicians are out there spending all this money and putting together all these ads, and either people aren't paying much attention or they're reading the first line of the story. Maybe they just wait till Labor Day.
What I will say, and again, I'm being probably a little bit overly cynical, because I know that a lot of these campaigns, at least I don't know as much about, you know, I know that Charlie Baker has been out there. He's been campaigning. You've seen him kind of shaking hands and meeting different people at different locations. I know that the grassroots campaigns of all three of these Democratic candidates are working really hard. It's sort of under the radar screen right now. Again, I am endorsing Martha Coakley, so I get emails from most of the campaigns, both from Steve Grossman's and from Martha Coakley's campaigns. And I think that Coakley's campaign claimed that they'd knocked on their 50,000th door. I think that the Grossman campaign is working in a similar fashion. So while I'm being kind of snarky on the one hand in terms of some of this, you know, public, either paid or unpaid media stuff, I know what's happening on the grassroots. And ultimately, that's something that you're not going to see until Election Day, what the hand-to-hand voter contact is going to mean for all of these candidates.
Yeah, but you know that virtually every poll says people, the most important factor when people go into a voting booth is what they see on television.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not suggesting to get out the vote and that stuff doesn't matter. But, you know, one of the problems I have, you know, Marjorie just said a minute ago, do they have to wait till Labor Day? There's a small problem with that. The primary is 8 days after Labor Day.
Well, you know,
so you get back to work on Tuesday, you're refocused on it's the fall, winter's coming, I got to get back into the work thing. And all of a sudden you have 7 days to decide. Forget governor. I'm obsessed with the fact, does anybody have any idea who's running for any other office? And maybe, you know, there's a hot attorney general race on the Democratic side. We have Republicans in here, Charlie Chipio, who can't name all the Republicans who are running for statewide office.
Who and couldn't?
What? No,
I'm sorry.
You only need the fingers on one hand.
But,
you
know, I can see you over there counting all those fingers.
You know,
Charlie,
I don't know what
job.
The law requires, but it seems to me, and I should have looked this up before I started, I assume the primary is on a day that's statutorily mandated. There shouldn't be an election 7 days after people come back from summer vacation. It's ridiculous.
We should do what a lot of other states do, and this primary should be at the beginning of June, you know, before people go away for the summer. And then, you know, so we know who the two candidates are at that point, or the two major party candidates.
And forget those useless
forward.
Conventions.
Yeah, please. Yes.
Christopher just emailed that Maine has their primary in the spring.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
A lot of places do.
Well, Shannon O'Brien, you've been around for a long
time.
It's
not my fault.
Yeah, do something, Shannon.
Explain this outrage, please.
I have
Shannon
my
O'Brien.
SPF properly applied today, I can tell you.
But it's a good point.
Milky Way bronze.
I know. Yeah.
Can we stay on the Democratic side? You know, one thing, I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering why we do this. Why we do this?
Because historically, that's what we've done.
That's a vestige.
It's just been around. It's been, you know, what we've done for a long time.
Right.
I mean,
it's not a very good reason, is it?
Well, and there's always someone who will be benefited by some change in the electoral process, in the fundraising process, in the, you know what I mean? So, you know, that is what makes it so sticky.
Let's stay on the Democrats for a second, then we're going to move to the Republican side. We got an email this morning from an unnamed person who said, why don't you ask Shannon O'Brien the following question? You were treasurer.
I'm going to look at your email.
Running for governor. Grossman is treasurer running for governor. By most accounts, I have no idea. Most people say he's done a very fine job as treasurer, creative, etc. What is it that you do as treasurer that you could possibly trumpet with the voters, where voters would say, aha, he or she was a great treasurer, they would make a great... Well, I'm serious about this. What do you say? I really kept those books balanced beautifully. I signed those bond things What do you do?
I mean, Joe Malone was, you know, running for governor and was considered a pretty strong candidate on the Republican side and went toe-to-toe with Paul Cellucci.
But arguably, he had more negativity coming out of some of the things that happened in his office for which he was not accused.
That was well after he ran. I was in a position as state treasurer, if you recall. Within a couple of weeks being in the state treasurer's office, we uncovered the theft of $9 million out of the state treasury. So a lot of down-ballot candidates, even people who've been incumbent treasurers, incumbent secretaries of state, I think that's less true for attorneys general because they tend to be on television a lot with high-profile legal cases. I was in the news a lot because we had a lot of cleaning up and a lot of work to do, and it was interesting. So I think that.
But I also think that today a treasurer has even more to campaign on than they did back then, because now the treasurer runs the school building authority, the treasurer runs the lottery, the treasurer runs the pension fund, which would be a big one.
ABC is what?
Alcohol and Beverage Commission. I'm sorry.
So, you know, I mean, a few of those are higher profile.
I think Steve has done a good job, you know, taking some of the more narrow responsibility, you know, more narrow than what the governor. Or even what the Attorney General does in terms of newsworthiness. Yeah. I think he's done a good job along those lines. He's been working to invest money in small banks and to help, you know, create investment in communities. You know, the lottery is something that's always in the news, but that's a double-edged sword when you're a public official affiliated with something that Marjorie's face already turns when I mention the word lottery, as does Jim's. But, you know, but so the fact is it's not as high profile as, say, Attorney General, but you can do some things that people care about.
You know, before we do turn to the Republicans, someone wrote a piece, and I forget who it was.
David Scharfenberg.
Thank you. David Scharfenberg in the Boston Globe
talked about how
we love outsiders in Massachusetts. Mitt Romney was an outsider when he came back in and sort of shoved Jane Swift aside. She was the governor then. Deval Patrick, obviously, great ground grassroots organizing outsider. Elizabeth Warren, to a certain degree, was an outsider.
Big total degree, I think.
And yet you have Don Berwick, who's got a really impressive resume. You see him as the outsider in this race. He really can't get above 5% in the polls.
You know, and I got to tell you, I've missed it twice on this because, I mean, up until now, it could change. You know, but I really thought that Berwick would really make a much bigger impact in the primary. But before that, you know, I thought that your new sometimes contributor, Juliette Kayyem, would.
Me too.
I thought she had the personality and she was an outsider. You know, I thought
different
that she
generation.
Would make a, yeah, I thought she would make a big splash. And then I was really surprised on both. You know, I thought that in both cases, you know, there are two candidates who, for the most part, would be running to the left in a Democratic primary. That combined with, you know, some of the personality issues, the outsider issues, I thought that they would both do much better than they did.
So why were you wrong? I mean, that's really the question that Scharfenberg is asking in his piece. Why do some outsiders prosper and other outsiders who are competent and have pretty impressive credentials go nowhere?
I'll tell you, I think that he did a much better job of answering it than I have until I read his article. I think it's a great article. But I think, you know, part of it is to me the fact that neither the casino nor the single payer issue have the kind of resonance that I think some
and
of us
thought
they
might. And he's the only 100% single player.
And he's the only 100% anti-casino. Yeah. I think, you know, neither of those issues are as big as we thought they might be. I think the other thing is that, you know, certainly Don Berwick doesn't have that kind of star power, that kind of a communication magic, you know, that Governor Patrick does. I mean, he's as other than Bill Clinton, I don't know anybody who's better at it than Governor Patrick is. So I think it's probably a combination of things.
But, you know, Juliette Kayyem has a lot of star power and a lot of charisma, and she did a great job at the convention. And when she's in here, she's got a huge personality. What's your analysis? You're another girl there, Shannon O'Brien.
I just don't think that. It requires a lot of different things, and every campaign is different. And someone coming in from out of left field who's never run for office before, who may have served in public office but never been part of the process. And again, you can complain about the Democratic convention and a lot of different things, but ultimately you have to have a field organization. You have to have a fundraising organization. You have to be able to, you know, command resources. And there are different candidates who can pull that together more quickly. Elizabeth Warren had She had star power before she even started in this race. She had people who would follow her to this race. She had people who would invest in her campaign before this even started, people who tried to draft her to run for the Senate. I think that people like Juliet Kynum and Don Berwick, they may be interesting. They may have really good resumes. But you have to have the mechanics to run a campaign as well.
Well, you know what else I thought about Kynum? She never wanted to talk about the fact that the two-woman race and that the fact that Martha Coakley's a woman and she's a woman, obviously, that this would she saw that as absolutely not a factor. I thought she was wrong about that. I think that was a factor.
She attacked me on a number of occasions for pointing that fact out. And my point is you can have more than one woman in a race. But in terms of being able to command the resources, in terms of being able to put together a statewide organization, it was really those things that she didn't have.
Yeah.
Had she been in that race and before Martha Coakley, because she got in before Martha Coakley did.
Yeah.
And it was about a year ago that I said, gee, if Martha Coakley gets in, this is going to be kind of tough for her. Because the point was, she didn't have the money. She didn't have the name recognition. She didn't have a field organization. And so if she were to be the only woman in the race, I felt that would have been a benefit to her, that maybe those other mechanical pieces would have come, and they never came.
You know, let's move to the Republican side. We're talking to Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer, former Democratic candidate for governor. Charlie Chipio used to work for Mitt Romney and now runs Chipio Strategies. Charlie, starting with you, I think you agreed with me, who agreed with Bill Weld, that Mark Fisher on the ballot, correct me if I'm wrong, was a good thing for Charlie Baker.
Yes, I think so.
Because essentially, as Weld said, I thought quite eloquently during the battle to get on the ballot by Fisher, when the state party was saying he didn't have the 15% at the convention, ultimately they capitulated and did, because it will show, because he's an admitted Tea Party guy, does not shy away, which I admire about him, is not one of these guys who's very conservative trying to pretend he's not. He is, and he says it. That it would make Charlie look even more moderate, which is what he's got to look like to win in a state like Massachusetts. Fisher was here with us the other day. He says he's campaigning like crazy. It seems to me, as a fairly close observer, that there's no, maybe it's the press's fault, but he's almost a non-player in this kind of thing. You're making a face. Yeah. You disagree with me?
No, I'm astonished by it. I mean, I
because he was in the news virtually every day when he was challenging to get on the ballot.
And he says he's campaigning like crazy. Maybe he is, but I mean, it's like, where's Waldo? I don't ever see anything. I don't see him.
I hear about
read
where's
about
Waldo
him.
All the time.
Right. I don't know. It's not really a campaign that makes sense for me. I don't know if it's a name recognition thing or what, but he certainly does not seem to me to be doing a whole lot.
And at the same time,
has he raised any money? And this is where my ignorance is. Has he been raising?
He has
any
39.
Money?
He corrected something. I said today. I said he'd raised $40,000 when he was here. He corrected, and he's right that he's actually raised a few hundred. He has $40,000 left in the bank, but with a month to go to the primary, $40,000 is tantamount to virtually nothing.
Right.
At the same time that Fisher has been, at least in the estimation of a couple of us, a fairly much of a non-presence, Charlie Baker has really, I thought, pretty brilliantly on most issues, played this moderate card, agreeing with Deval Patrick for the most part, with some hesitations on the immigration thing, which is obviously a very emotional issue, embracing Bob DeLeo's gun control bill, even though with me the other day he didn't want to take a position on what the rights, what powers, expanded powers, the police chiefs would have. Would you not acknowledge, as a loyal Democrat, he's done a good job of recreating, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, I mean it in a observant way, recreating an image that is the image that if a Republican is to win, he's got to have in this state.
I'm a Democrat, and I'm supporting a Democratic candidate for governor, but I like Charlie Baker. And I think that one of the things that I have seen about Charlie Baker in the 20 potential some odd years that I've known him is that he has a very strong capacity to learn from his mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I didn't like Charlie Baker all that much when he first came into the Weld administration because I thought he was arrogant. I thought he didn't understand how to sort of work with other people who had different ideas. And I think he learned from Bill Weld that you kind of have to listen sometime. And I think he's a much better candidate this time.
Why'd you
Charlie
laugh?
Chipio.
I'm smiling because, you know, I briefly worked in the Weld administration a million years ago when Charlie Baker and I were both very young. And I had just – it was a very odd situation because I had just come off working for Paul Tsongas when he ran for president. And I started in the Weld administration. And one of the first days that I was there, my first time I ever laid eyes on Charlie Baker was at one of these cabinet meetings on the road somewhere in Western Massachusetts, and I walked into the room, and there was Charlie Baker, who I didn't know who he was or anything, and I just walk into the room, and Charlie Baker is at this cabinet meeting. His arms are waving. There's a tirade of four-letter words, you know,
out of Charlie.
Oh yeah, and this is,
and you know, I think it had to do with Western Mass Hospital, which was in my district, which was a big issue.
But
he lost on that one, and that's what he learned.
He has certainly, as have I, in the intervening time, I think, grown up a little and calmed down a bit.
But you know, but you know what's interesting about this? Virtually nobody except the Democratic Party, whose job it is to do this, is accusing him of flip-flopping. I mean, no one is saying, well, wait a second. You know, you were against driver's license for illegal immigrants. You're against in-state tuition. All of a sudden, you're soft on these immigrant kids.
But I think they will be after September.
Yeah, just wait a little while.
Yeah,
wait till after. Yeah. It's very hard right now because you don't have a settled nominee on the Democratic side to literally be like, you know, shoot out at the OK Corral and attacking here and attacking there. I think that with the Democratic candidates, you know, I mean, Steve Grossman aside, who is sort of in, a different position in his campaign. But I think that a lot of these candidates are still defining themselves with the voters, you know, in the event that they win the primary. Mm-hmm.
But Jeff McCormick, who's running as an independent, of course, has come out differently on this whole issue of taking in these children and these teenagers that are coming from over the border into Massachusetts. And I wrote this in the Herald. This could be a wedge issue for McCormick because a lot of conservative Republicans are very, very upset about that. And Paul
McMorrow, a lot of Democrats, too, by the way, and independents are upset about it.
And Paul McMorrow did an analysis of the polling in Commonwealth Magazine and found that McCormick could be a threat because the votes, unlike the last time around when Baker ran against
Cahill.
He ran against Deval Patrick and Cahill took away 8% of the votes. According to his analysis, they came both from Deval Patrick and from Charlie Baker. But in this case, he seems to think that the McCormick votes are all going to come from Charlie Baker.
Paul did a really good job on this. You know, whereas, and I think he's right. I mean, whereas I think that there is this fallacy that a lot of people who worked for Charlie last time around put forth that, you know, somehow it was all Cahill's fault, which it wasn't. I do think that unlike the last time, almost all of the votes for McCormick will come from Baker, and I think it is an issue.
And you could see it, at least some of them, on this immigration issue, which drives people's passions over the edge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's an interesting poll, and I think it'll be interesting.
And I think there's one more interesting thing about Baker is too that he's dropped 5 points. He was closer to
against Martha,
and one of the
changes. I think it was those Hobby Lobby comments.
Exactly. Well, the big thing about Charlie Baker last time, there was a huge gender gap. Women were not voting for Charlie Baker, and I think this time around he's trying to be the softer, kinder, nicer Charlie Baker, but who is hurt by saying that the Hobby Lobby decision was no big deal in Massachusetts.
You know, Shannon and I were on the cutting edge here. We were here the day that decision came down.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
That's right.
But I mean, did you say the bad word?
Shannon just said that's right. She has no recollection of this. I can tell
by
looking
at
her face
when
she said
it. I have no idea.
But what do you think about that, Charlie Chippio of Chippio Strategies? The Hobby Lobby, his initial pronouncements, and he backtracked, by the way.
Yeah.
But his initial pronouncements on Hobby Lobby saying it wasn't a big deal in Massachusetts.
Look, doesn't matter here.
Yeah, you know what? Here's what I think. I think he's a really smart guy who very often looks at these things from a very, you know, fact-based point of view. And I think that that's the approach he took on it. And I think that sort of very analytical approach is not necessarily one that is effective in politics.
And yeah, I for one can tell you that being analytical about the abortion issue is not a smart thing to do. And that I think he made a mistake there.
Yep.
You know, that being said, I still think that as goes some of the craziness in Washington has an impact on Republican candidates in this state. Even though, I mean, I think that this is a tougher thing, and I've said this before on this show, it's a tougher thing for Senate candidates.
Much tougher.
When you know, D.C. goes kind of off the rails on, you know, and I think even, you know, I mean, but I do think that that can have an impact on Trump.
I want to stay on that one second, but first, for those who are saying, what is she talking about? For those who are not around when you ran against Mitt Romney or he ran against you, depending on your point of view, the issue was underage people getting consent. Was that the one where
it was the age of consent to have an abortion. And frankly, Romney supported those as he was governor because they were happening all the time with judges' interventions. So my point was I tried to answer this rationally as opposed to really talking about the issue because even people in this state and that polling was talking a little bit that you're referencing this, I forget whose poll it was, but people in this state are generally pro-choice. However, there are nuances to their support for abortion. And when you start getting down into these different areas, it changes. And so you have to be very careful, even in a very liberal and pro-choice state like Massachusetts, about not answering those questions analytically if you want this to really resonate with a lot of people.
And it was really too bad because you were right about the 16-year-olds. I mean, many of them are not going to go to their parents. They're not going to go. You know, they need an opportunity to
The
go.
Logical answer I gave is that the age of consent in this state to have sexual relations was that age. And that's what I said, is that if that's the age that you can have sex, you should be able to determine what happens to your body at that age as well. Again, that sounds like a very logical answer, but it's not a winning one.
That'll teach you. Can we get back to what Shannon said a minute ago, Charlie Chipio? I am generally of the belief, I think this is where Shannon was going too, and I think Marjorie is too. There's this fundamental unfairness when you're running for governor if you get tarnished if you're a Republican by some of the wackos on the House side, on the Republicans. However, on this immigration issue, where Charlie Baker, I think much to the dismay of some very conservative people in the state, has basically embraced the Deval Patrick position, again, saying, I want to make sure that the federal money is there. I don't want us to get saddled, et cetera. When you have Republicans running out of town in the House, passing a bill that in part would pretty much deport, it won't become law for obvious reasons, deport virtually all of the 10,000s of kids, regardless what they'd be going home to, almost immediately. That is so, it seems to me, is so extreme and so irrational that there is potential for that to trickle up. And maybe it's only a point or a point and a half, but there is potential for that to tar this guy, isn't
point,
there?
A point or a point and a half could make a difference. And I think, you know, I mean, look, I think you're right. I read that stuff and it just makes me sick. You know, I mean, you know, to think that, you know, the place that the United States has historically occupied in the world, that this country should be a country that just sees these kids, you know, who have faced just hell, and that what we do is say, oh, no, sorry, and just we're supposed to, like, throw them back into the fire. I mean, that's just – look, I mean, there has to be limits and there has to be all the stuff about, you know, the feds are going to pick up the cost and all that stuff. Granted, but I don't know. I just don't understand how your attitude can be, you know, the hell with them, send them back.
It's well, you know what's interesting about this, too, because the hot-button issue, of course, are these kids and these teenagers. The other ones are driver's licenses for illegal immigrants and in-state tuition for illegal immigrants. Now, interestingly, McCormick – is in favor of those, and Charlie Baker is not. So there's a division there on the immigration issue, and I suppose that if you're opposed to any kind of amnesty or any kind of break for illegal immigrations, what upsets you more, in-state tuition, driver's licenses, or taking these children?
Well, I mean, look, I can tell you my own opinion is that I can understand at least the arguments against in-state tuition and against driver's licenses. I have trouble understanding the idea that you're supposed to take these innocent kids and throw them back into a place where they're going to be terrorized and probably killed. You know, those are distinguishable to me.
It'll make for interesting debate because, again, a lot of these candidates, I think because Charlie has worked very hard to sort of maintain that moderate position, it'll be interesting to see as the immigration debate goes on a national level what that does to the governor's race. It could be. Yeah. We talked, and I think the last time I was on here, that casinos might be the defining issue in this campaign. I think that it probably could be immigration that becomes.
But, you know, you're right. I think it hurts Richard to say more than it hurts. I mean, I think it could hurt.
Who's running for Congress against John Tierney, assuming Tierney wins his primary? We're talking to Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio. Can we return to a topic of last week? Since you served in the legislature, I continue, and again, I've searched this fairly thoroughly, and I may have missed somebody, with the exception of the Speaker of the House, Bob DeLeo, who obviously has responded to virtually everything that came out of the probation trial and the juror who wrote me last week and all that sort of stuff, which is understandable because his name is in the news. I believe, Shannon, that there's not one other Democrat on Beacon Hill, not one, who is set in the legislature, who has said anything like, we get the message from the trial, we have to change things. Believe me, we're sensitive to the fact that we may have made there is no recognition that this probation corruption trial has anything to do with them because no one was indicted. Is that an unfair statement?
Well, the only thing I'll say is that when this story first broke a couple of years ago, I do believe I recall that there was some legislation about
jobs. Yeah, there was, 2011,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that there were some proactive steps before this case was ever deliberated and decided by
a jury. Yeah, but you would acknowledge that about 99.9% of the public has no, unfairly, has no recollection
of
that. Okay.
Has no recollection of that, nor did I until I started thinking about what we were going to be talking about on this show today. That, you know, but I do believe that I think they're still sort of shocked by this, because I think that a lot of the comments that the judge made repeatedly about patronage is not a crime, patronage is not a crime, I think people are still shocked to find that the jury, after hearing testimony for weeks upon weeks, after hearing some of the jury instructions, and then, you know, listening to this, I think that some of them are still in shock. I do think that also because a lot of political people, I've been on the receiving end, I've been on the giving end, letters of recommendation, that whole thing. I think that now they're trying to figure out, what do we do?
And, yeah, but so wait. I understand, what do you do? I get that. And you may, but you're telling me that when you were in the legislature, you would have not said to yourself, hey, either because I believe it or because I have to do it, I'm going to say, and I may say no more.
I think they may not know what's happening right now.
Sense is that, at least on the House side, I can't speak. Well, I can. On the Senate side, you have Terry Murray, who's outgoing, who committed one of the most egregious recommendations, where this guy was ultimately fired for heroin possession, who was deemed woefully unqualified. So you don't want to aggravate her, even though she's outgoing.
Yeah.
And Bob DeLeo, since he was in the middle of this mess, I would argue unfairly, if he did something wrong, you should indict him, Carmen Ortiz. You shouldn't badmouth him. I would argue that the average state rep is saying, if I say something like, I get it, and we have to make change, that it's in an indirect criticism of your boss, the speaker.
I agree, and I also think that, I just think that people don't, I don't know if there's an, I don't know if, I don't think there's another shooter drop, but I think that people may not know if there's another shooter drop.
I think there are three things on this. One is, you know, one is that I think they're trying to figure out where the line is now.
Right, exactly.
Because going forward, the game has changed, and they need to figure out where the line is now.
But isn't the line fairly clear? That patronage is not a crime, but you can't recommend people that are wholly unqualified and have them
no,
pumped to
right,
the top of the
right.
list.
But the idea is that all this I've got a column coming out in the Herald in the next couple of days with Mary Connaughton. We're talking about what does this mean in terms of some other stuff that's been done that's egregious, that's public. Is that now criminalized? You know, that's the
like
question.
Like a Republican candidate for auditor, for those who don't recall.
Yeah.
Got,
like what?
Like the Convention Center Authority making absolutely absurd projections about how much the revenue from the hotel tax is going to triple, and that's how they're going to be able to afford the rate of the increase is going to triple, and that's how they're going to afford this expansion. There's that. The second thing is that why don't we just have it so that every time a legislature writes a letter of recommendation for somebody, it goes to the Secretary of State, the Inspector General, somewhere. It's there. It's public. You can see
that's
it
Charlie
online.
Baker's reform proposal, for it's worth. One of the pieces.
I didn't even know that, to be honest with you. But that's what you should do. And the third thing is, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, look, when you got one side running the show completely, this is the stuff you get. And believe me, the Republicans' incompetence is certainly part of the is part of what's responsible for that. But, you know, this
you
is
you forgot
one of
Weld's walruses? Is that what's happened
for
the years?
You know, it's not a good thing.
But I do think they're still trying to find their footing right now, what this is, because, you know, my take on the trial is that patronage is not a crime. But when you had a system within this office that was allowed to run amok for so many different years and that they were able to set up a system that was ultimately fraudulent, to me, that and it's almost – the sad thing is it's a matter of degree as opposed to what the process is. And I do think that, you know, maybe you do have some legislators. I mean, again, no one remembers the reforms that, you know, were put in place a couple of different years ago in terms of transparency and in terms of, you know, how they use legislative recommendations, but they probably need to do more.
You know, I have a question for you, Shannon O'Brien, because you've been a politician for a long time. If a constituent called you and said, I've got a kid, just got out of Yale, your alma mater, well, maybe I shouldn't say Yale, just got out of some college, good kid, and you said, fine, you know, I'll pass this along. Did you get credit from that constituent for just saying, I'll do what I can, I'll pass this along? I mean, you didn't have to, like, obviously fix the system. Didn't you get the credit for just talking to them and helping them?
I mean, as a political person, you'd get asked to write letters of recommendation. I was pretty stingy with that.
Yeah.
I will give you one example, but someone who's going to remain nameless, but someone who was a state senator who signed off on a a document for a notary public, and it ended up the person was like mobbed up. I was always extremely careful. You know, I won't say that there weren't people who, you know, were less than stellar, you know, that you'd write, but I always tried to be extremely honest about how much I knew the person. And if it was not at all, you know, I know their mother, I know their, you know what I mean? I would always be very careful about that. But I will tell you, as a recipient of these letters, and this is one of the things about the probation scandal, which, you know, was troubling to me, is that it's, you know, I always felt that it was one thing, okay, you know, hiring and taking those letters of recommendations. But if you don't have integrity in the promotion process, that is almost worse than having it in the hiring process, because then you can't run the things.
Yeah,
and that's what I paid some prices for on occasion, is that if you can't have a management structure with reduced political influence, then no one gives a damn about doing their job. And that, to me, is the worst part of what you saw. It's not just the hiring. The worst part of what you saw in those sham interviews was the promotions and who was running. Because the people who are in there who are doing good work, why do you want to work hard if you know that the promotions are not on the level? That was, to me, the worst that I
saw. I spent less time in state government than you did, but from the time I was there, I saw that in many offices what you had was you sort of had the shadow office where it was all the people that are there for whatever, for political reasons, and then you had this other group who are actually the group that did all the work, you know, and that was very often the way.
Shannon, I think your point was great, but with all due respect, the fact that you think that mob figures have no right to notarization is really small-minded.
I think it's something to think about.
Hey, before you go away, we only have a minute left. We're going to talk in a couple of minutes with a 41-year employee now fired of Market Basket. What's going on? Obviously, today's the day of judgment. They say they're going to start replacing him if they don't go back to work today. Very quickly, Shannon O'Brien, are you not surprised, because I am, about how tepid the support for the worker side of this has been from most leaders and would-be leaders? All say we want a peaceful – we're going to play some of this in a few minutes – peaceful resolution. We hope people get back to work. If it turns out this was a union, these candidates be marching on the picket line with these people. What is up with this?
If this were a union, I believe that there would be a difference. But I also – the history here of this family blood feud that has had the good guys – on one side, the good guys, on the other side, the bad guys. We don't know who's good and bad in this whole story. And I think that people are looking at this as decisions are not necessarily being made in a terms of rational how a business would be run. And people know this. It's been around for 20 years.
Yeah, so but nobody knew about it until the last couple of years.
So quickly, Charlie, what's your take?
My take is that my good friend and mentor and idol, Jim Browdy, captured this when he had Governor Patrick on. And Governor Patrick, who's usually so smooth and can talk his way out of anything, he was just doing the humina when you asked him why he was all crazy about the Hyatt maids.
Hyatt maids.
But wasn't doing anything about this. And I can answer that in four letters, SEIU. That's why.
Service Employees International. Okay. Hey, Shannon, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
And you, Charlie, as well. Take care, you too.
Shannon O'Brien is a former state treasurer and Democratic gubernatorial candidate or nominee. Well, yes, you were both, weren't you?
Nominee.
Charlie Chipio runs Chipio Strategies. He also worked. I know.
We were
rooting for you,
you,
Shannon.
Rub it in every time.
Charlie also worked in the Romney administration. Thanks so much for being here. Up next, as Jim said, we are going to get the latest on the Market Basket contretemps and ask you if your local politicians should make a stand. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, we continue our Meet the Gubernatorial Candidate conversations. Joining me this time will be Evan Falchuk from the United Independent Party. That's tomorrow, only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Today at WGBHnews.org, listen to the series that just won an Edward R. Murrow Award for the Best Investigative Reporting, Philip Martin's Exposé of Human Trafficking, at WGBHnews.org right now.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and K&L Gates, more than 2,000 lawyers across five continents. To learn how their global law firm can help you with your challenging legal issues, no matter your location, you can visit klgates.com.
and Vintage Rochester from WGBH's Antiques Roadshow. See how items appraised at a 1998 visit to Rochester, New York have changed in value, for better or for worse. That's on Antiques Roadshow, tonight at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The Market Basket Uprising, as you probably know, is entering its third week as workers continue to rally on behalf of ousted CEO Arthur T. Demoulas. Market Basket brass are demanding that workers restock the shelves so the business can get back to usual or potentially be replaced. Market Basket employees say slow business has nothing to do with the store's inventory. Rather, it's about customer solidarity. In a couple of minutes, we're going to ask you what we just asked Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio. Why is it that the political leaders and would-be leaders of Massachusetts have been at least careful in their support here? Most of them, anyway. But first, joining us on the line for an update is Tom Traynor. Tom was a distribution supervisor at Market Basket for 41 years. He was fired along with several of his coworkers a couple of weeks ago. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Tom. So, oops, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Tom, I'm wondering what you hear. You know, today is the ultimatum day. Are you hearing that people are going back to work, or are you hearing just the opposite?
I'm out here at, first off, the only places that people have not gone to work is the warehouses and the main office.
Yeah.
The stores are still going to work every day. And I'm out here, as I have been every day for a couple of weeks, across picketing in front of the warehouse in the main office. And I can tell you that I did not see one person that had not already crossed the line from the beginning of it go in today.
So, in other words, the warehouses are not going to be able to take in the food, and the food is going to continue to be absent from the stores.
Well, they do have some temporary workers in there, but they've been putting out a small fraction, maybe 5% of what we would normally process through the warehouse on a daily basis.
Tom, you know, we spoke to you. You had just recently gotten a letter saying you don't work here after four decades. You were everybody. The reaction we got, very strong, very resolute, that sort of thing. How are you, 10 days after we spoke to you? Are you still in the same place? You're beginning to get nervous? Where are you, Tom Traynor?
I'm stronger than ever. And I think there's about 1,500 people out here with me today. And, you know, that's kind of been the strength of this picket since last Tuesday or so, you know. Every day there's a thousand or better people here. And there's customers out here with us with signs saying that I'm a customer. You can't find me, I quit. And they're standing side by side with associates.
Are you more hope? I mean, we know since we last spoke to you, Arthur T. Demoulas has made an offer to buy the company. In the last 24 hours, we heard that he said, in the interim, I am willing to come back and run the ship and bring the Tom Traynors back with me to get this ship afloat until such time as I take over. Are you optimistic about the outcome here, or at least more optimistic than you might have been 10 days ago?
Well, I think if you look at what happened here, that just shows you the character of the man. He cares more about the associates and the customers than he does about dollars and cents. He's willing to come back with no guarantee that he's going to get this company back to put it on its, because he knows that on the current path we're on, we're not going to be able to last much longer. And, you know, and it shows on the other side, it seems like the whole world is against ASD. I mean, I think his two sisters, Fotine and Diana, have to wake up here, as well as Rafaela Evans, who caused this by shifting her allegiance a year ago.
That was the swing vote that turned the tide. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
They have to wake up. And I mean, we know we're dealing with Arthur S. We know how he is. And obviously, he's got a lot of hate in his heart. But, you know, are you really going to lose everything and walk away with nothing? Because that's the way it's going.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I have wondered in this whole thing, Tom Traynor, is that this battle between these two cousins is going on for so many years with so much venom, and family fights can be the worst of all, that you almost wonder if Arthur S. is willing for the ship to sink.
You'd have to ask Arthur S. that, but I would think that his two sisters and his sister-in-law are smarter than that. You know, We feel that Raphael may have shifted her allegiance because of money, because she thought that Arthur S. could get her more dividends. Well, if she's really interested in money, then maybe she ought to make her own deal.
Hey, Tom, by the way, there is the rally that some people thought was today that you all are doing in Tewksbury is tomorrow at 10 a.m. Is that correct?
11 a.m.
11 a.m., sorry. The one other thing I have, though, for you is when I spoke to you the first time and then the second time, I asked you the same question I'll ask a third time, which is, have any of you had any contact with Arthur T? And you told me at the time the answer was no. Is it still no?
Yeah, I have not talked to Arthur T since the morning of June 23rd when he was terminated later on that day.
Has there been any attempt by any of you who have spent decades of your life to reach out to him, or you're just doing what you're doing and he's doing what he's doing?
We're doing what we think he would want us to do. And we know that he's fighting 24/7 with his family trying to get this deal done. And just, you know, the fact that he offered to come in and run the company without a guarantee last night to get it back on track shows you what kind of man he is, you know?
Well, Tom Traynor...
He doesn't want it. He doesn't want... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go, you go
no,
ahead.
You go ahead.
He doesn't want to see any more of his associates fired, you know? But we're... I've stated many times in rallies, we're just not normal, you know?
That's a great line, Tom, and I think you mean it in the best sense of the word, and I think we would agree. Tom, we wish you luck. I really appreciate your time again, and good luck with your rally tomorrow at 11 o'clock in Tewksbury.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Tom Traynor was with Market Basket for 41
years.
Okay, we are opening up the lines to you, asking you if you think the employees deserve the support from our politicians. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. And the email address, Jim?
The email address is BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, BPRWGBH.org. You know, before we take your calls, and the thing we do want to focus on is we know that the vast majority of you support what the employees are doing. That's fine. You can say that. But what struck both Marjorie and me when we were talking over the weekend is that there has been some reserve on the part of elected leaders and would-be elected leaders about getting involved in this thing. So I want to play you a couple of their comments before we get to your calls, which we will at 877-301-8970. First of all, here's the governor with us on this show, on this radio show, on July 24th.
It's a family matter, and it's a pretty dysfunctional family, from what I can tell, from what I've read, and that's not going to be solved by this governor or any other governor intervening.
Speaking of any other governor, I asked comparable questions of Charlie Baker, the likely Republican nominee. He was on TV with me last Wednesday. I quizzed him a little bit with a quote about the dispute. Here it is. I want economic peace in the Commonwealth, but that's a private dispute, as far as I can tell, among private family members in a private company. Obviously talking about Market Basket. Yeah. You know who that was?
I don't, but it sounds sort of like something that I said.
Well, it's actually Deval Patrick.
Okay.
And now here's what you said. At the same time, Market Basket is a private company, and so we can only hope that an amicable resolution protecting the jobs of everyone involved can be found.
His is more articulate than mine. Yeah.
That's a pretty good line. And then finally, to complete the circle, the woman who is leading the pack on the Democratic side got involved as Attorney General. Here's Martha Coakley. Last Thursday, talking about Market Basket.
We wanted to make sure, since it seems like it's moving to a stage where there may be terminations, there may be firings, we just wanted to remind the administration that Massachusetts and New Hampshire law requires certain benefits for termination. They're not layoffs, they would be firings, terminations. We hope that doesn't happen. We hope that there's a happier ending to that.
So that is the current governor, the leading Democrat who would be governor, and the leading Republican who would be governor. And there's some reserve in their comments. Don't you think that's a fair description of all three of them?
Well, yes, but there's some reserve from some of the responses we're getting as well.
Saying
on
what?
Facebook. Well, Ryan said on Facebook, no, the politicians shouldn't get involved. Adding politicians to a situation is a surefire way to make things worse than they already are. The workers don't need politicians to show up. They're doing just fine on their own. Arch just emailed and said, first, it's a private company. The politicians should stay out of it. Second, the politicians won't because non-union workers aren't a readily identifiable voting, fundraising, sign-holding bloc like unions are. So there's not a definite upside. And they're probably afraid to do anything that shows them supporting non-union workers.
Well, I'll give you what I think is an upside. First of all, most unions I know are supporting these workers, even though it's a non-union workplace. And secondly, you don't think if you were on the evening news at tomorrow's rally in Tewksbury with, what are they going to have, 12,000, 15,000 people there, you don't think that accrues to your benefit if you're a candidate for statewide office? I would say it does in a serious sort of way. But even if it didn't, even if it wasn't election season, I'm just surprised that more leading politicians are not wading in. And by the way, Charlie Baker and, as you heard, and Baker and Deval Patrick, the current governor, are both saying what that email is. It's a private company. And while we hope that there's a decent outcome, there's only so much that a governor can do. I'm surprised.
Let's go to Ken from Leominster. Thanks for calling, Ken. Hi.
Hey, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say, when all this started, I've been shopping at Market Basket for 15 or 20 years. And I was under the assumption that all supermarkets were the same. The only complaint I ever really had about Market Basket was that it was too crowded. But now I'm finding my food bill has gone up $20 a week, and I can't get the brands that I like. I found it in sandwich meat and in yogurt, and I think Arthur T. built that, and he's the only one that's going to make it come back.
Hey, Ken, thanks for the call. By the way, let me do the math.
It's
$1,000 a year.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that Ken said that because someone at our news meeting this morning was saying the exact same thing, that she'd shopped at Market Basket for years. And they say these other chains are saying that the prices are the same. And she's saying, well, they're not. They're not. And that is one of the things that is astonishing. You find such diversity in Market Basket, all these exotic fruits and things like octopus and stuff like that. And you find really high-end things that they sell in places like Whole Foods at – you know, a buck off. I mean, it's amazing. I guess the reason they were able to do it is because they own a lot of the property. What are you laughing at?
Marjorie, by the way, if you don't know
it's
Marjorie well through the
bread.
Radio,
I'm
Marjorie,
obsessed.
There's one kind of bread that she's obsessed with, and she compared the price.
It's
it was a dollar cheaper. That's all she needs to know. But by the way, let's just stay with that guy, Ken from Leominster, for a minute.
Yeah.
In terms of politicians' deeper involvement, which most people seem to think, including the politicians themselves, I'm wrong about, $1,000 for Ken's family impacts voters. Your constituents. Two, vendors. Our small vendors, which supply, are in deep trouble because they're not accepting shipments.
Some of them are afraid of going out of business.
Thirdly, there are potentially thousands and thousands of people who live in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, which is why the New Hampshire Attorney General got involved with Martha Coakley, who could lose their jobs. I mean, what are triggers for politicians to get involved in a setting, private company or not? Huge cost increases for their constituents, huge number of constituents losing their jobs, and huge number of small businesses losing their market. So, it surprises me that there's not deeper involvement, but there's virtual bipartisan unanimity that they should stay out.
Jonas from Lawrence, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Jonah.
From the glorious city of the 1912 strike, 35,000 laborers, all non-union, went out and changed America's labor history.
Mm.
This is the exact same thing. Everyone around here is talking about the 1912 strike because it's so many similarities. The people behind us, elderly, young, no one's going. Everyone's buzzing. Did you buy anything there? No. You can go in and still find half the stuff on the shelves, spaghetti, pasta sauce, you know, a multitude of different things, still much cheaper, but no one's buying it. I'm paid $27 more for my last week's grocery at Stop and Shop. Kentucky ham that I buy at Market Basket, $3.99. It's $5.99.
Wow.
The eggs, $1.89 instead of $1.19. You add that up, within three small bags, I spent $27 more. I have my previous week's receipts and this week's receipts. I know the difference.
Hey.
And this is affecting everyone. It's affecting, like, for example, for Gioni Farm and Baca Farm in Andover, North Andover. They're selling zucchini and corn. They can't sell it because they're not being purchased by Market Basket, who supports our local farms.
Mm-hmm.
And how about that 4%? How about that 4% extra deal off you get at the checkout? I think that's a pretty exciting,
you know,
too.
This screwball idea that I have to buy a card, and if I'm not a member of yours, I'm not elite enough to get a discount. And then all of a sudden, Market Basket comes 4% clear across the board. We like you as a customer. We care about you here. Here's a little something put in your pocket.
Hey, Jonas, before you go away, as an historian, which you obviously are, how do you feel about the fact that most of the top politicians and would-be politicians in the state are keeping their arm's length from this?
I am so glad you asked this question. Isn't it funny? Deval Patrick, who is CEO, rubs elbows with the billionaires and trillionaires. He isn't supporting it. Isn't it funny?
No, first of all, it's not fair to say he's not supporting it. I think
he's keeping his arms distant.
Yeah, he
is. But isn't it funny? He could do something by talking to them. And, you know, it's funny. We used, whenever Market Basket has gone in and put in, like, say, in Chelsea, where they called under the federal programs food deserts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, they put a big market in to assist the working class in a working neighborhood. You know, that's federal, state, and local monies that are being spent for that. So we're utilizing federal and state money to do it, and our federal people are not standing behind us. Neither has Warren, Markey. And Markey, when he campaigned on TV, he showed where his grandfather came from in South Lawrence, and, you know, he was a struggling, you know, person from the old country, and he says, we understand the working class. Hey, it was good when you wanted to get a vote to say you came to Lawrence and understood the working class. How about today when I went to pick up my mother last week at the senior center and all the old cronies are all crying because what they're spending out of their pocket, they don't have it in their budget.
Hey, Jonas, wow. That was a great call. And since you mentioned Markey and Warren, here's Elizabeth Warren. This is courtesy of Fox 25 talking about this very same place, Market Basket.
I think that the management really risks destroying a lot of value in that company and a lot of value in having built up a workforce that treats the place like family. So I'm just really shocked
by it. You're talking about next week potentially starting to fire people. Do you expect...
I'm really shocked by that, and I think they're making a mistake. I think they're making a mistake.
But will you get involved?
I think they're making a mistake.
So, well, it speaks for itself. 877-301-8970.
Are you getting involved? Yes or no would have been the way to go. Keith says that in the New Bedford store on Saturday afternoon, there weren't even 10 cars in the Market Basket parking lot.
Let's go take another call or two, squeeze them in anyway. Let's go to Stephen Taunton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Steve, thanks for the call.
I think I applaud the politicians for not weighing in on a private matter, to be honest with you.
Why is that?
It's none of their business. This is a private concern. Going first of all, this is a family squabble. It's like you having an argument with your aunt, your mother, and your brother, and this other person's going to come in and try to settle it.
Yeah, but Steve, there's one major difference, and I respect your position. If I had an argument with my brother, I don't have a brother, but if I had a brother, I had an argument like that, it wouldn't cost you $1,000 more a year. It wouldn't mean small vendors couldn't sell their goods, and it wouldn't mean that hundreds, if not thousands, of employees could lose their jobs. I acknowledge it's a private company, Steve. The difference is it's a private company which has huge public impacts. No?
Every day in every state in the union.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing new here.
I hear you.
You know, so what? And let me give you a story. I went into the Market Basket in Taunton, a longtime customer. And I went up to the young lady that's been there. She's got to be there 10 or 12 years. And I said to her, what's the problem? And she firmly believes that the brother, the Arthur Reston, not the Arthur P, right?
Yeah.
Personally wants to destroy the other cousin by making this Market Basket go down the tubes.
Well, that's a question Marjorie asked not so long ago. Is the animus strong enough that's all that really matters, is beating your cousin?
They got to do a fist
Steve,
fight.
Steve, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
In court a few years back. Remember the stories about that?
No, I do. And, you know, by the way, for those who think that's not possible, there are a lot of family disputes, some in this region, that have reached the point where the only thing that mattered was destroying the relative, not...
Really? Were there some other ones I should know
about?
Yeah,
yes, there are quite a few. And you know some. Actually,
oh,
you know some of the people.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
You do.
All right, well, I better not get into it then.
In any case,
sure
we will obviously
about.
Monitor this thing. You know that 4 o'clock there's this job fair with the first of a couple this afternoon. Tomorrow morning is the rally at 11 o'clock in Tewksbury. We will stay on top of it because it's something a lot of people care about.
But up next is time to get all revved up with the Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe. Keep your dial here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Because the vast majority of funding for 89.7 is provided by listeners, this program is available for free to you, your family, your friends, and all of your neighbors near and far. Thanks so much.
Which Boston communities remain affordable while others move beyond their middle class roots? For the next story in our continuing series on rediscovering the middle class, we look at Hingham. This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Support for our programs comes from you
And Gardner Mattress, featuring custom-made mattresses in three showrooms. Gardner Mattress, handmade since 1933. More information online at GardnerMattress.com. That's GardnerMattress.com. And UMass Lowell, offering part-time graduate and undergraduate degrees online or on campus. Fall classes start September 3rd at UMass Lowell. You can learn more at continuinged.uml.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Move over, no drama, Obama. We now have no drama, Papa. Pope Francis is urging bishops to tone down the exuberance and outpouring of affection. This is true when the sign of peace is exchanged during Mass. Joining us to talk about this and other matters concerning religion and moral leadership is Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a syndicated columnist. And Reverend Emmett Price, he's on the phone, by the way, today. He's also a professor of music at Northeastern University. Good to talk to you both.
Great to be here. Hey, Emmett.
Great to be here. Hey, what's up, y'all?
Hello. Hello. Well, let's start with this Scituate congregation where parishioners have had this held a 10-year vigil, 24/7, around the clock, to hold on to their church. Cardinal Sean O'Malley has sent a letter to them telling them it's basically over at St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. They've got to accept this Vatican rule that the archdiocese has to sell or reuse the building, and they're refusing to leave. I mean, these people have been at it round the clock for 10 years.
24/7, 10
years.
Yeah,
24/7. I remember going down there a few years ago and interviewing these people. They would have, like, mattresses they'd pull out, and they could sleep there at night and stuff like that. What do you make of this, Irene Monroe?
I'm in solidarity with them. I send them my prayers. I'm hoping they're listening as I give my reasons. First of all, I just think it's desecrating the worshiping life and will of the people. But the really subtext here is that the church really wants to sell this property. This is 30.3 acres of wonderful, prime coastal real estate.
On the ocean.
That's right. For profane use. Not profound, but for profane use. And so I'm with them. This church, there's no reason for this church really to fold. There's a couple of reasons. It's still today, even with its 24/7, watch, has well over 3,000 registered families. The church was built by the parishioners. It's one of the younger churches in the archdiocese. Its coffers, now this, because it's about money, 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 its coffers on any given Sunday before this happened, six figures.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do with this? And also, it was so financially secured that it built a sister church and a school in India. And just one other thing, where there's a noted, shortage of priests, this church didn't have that problem. So I give them my blessing. Fight.
And by the way, there's somebody, Emmett, before we get to you, who agrees with Irene. It's John Rogers. He's the spokesman for St. Francis X Cabrini in Scituate. Listen to what he had to say on Fox 25 this morning.
It's in the archdiocese eyes, it's about the almighty buck. This was a pure land grab, and we knew it. They understand it, and something needed to be done about it, and that was us.
Emmett Price, on one hand, what Cardinal O'Malley is saying is, by implication, since you got engaged in the arbitration process, we assume, he says, you'll abide by the outcome, which they say no to. On the other hand, they say, and I heard this morning and in prior days, we're willing to buy the place. So if it turns out, even if John Rogers and Irene Monroe are right, why not just sell it to the people who have shown their incredibly deep commitment to this for a decade and more, Emmett Price?
Well, I think it goes back to Market Basket. I mean, you have a feud in the family, right? I mean, here you have this great, this great parish. And I have great admiration and great respect for these parishioners who have stood the test of time for 10 years and done everything that we as pastors and clergy teach them to do, to be lovers of one another as their neighbors and to be compassionate and to be in solidarity with one another. And, essentially what they're doing is phenomenal. So, I think the archdiocese has to take a L here in the win-loss column and allow these folks to buy this property and to be a freestanding, free will Catholic church. One of the things about in religion, you have these numerous reformations
And oftentimes we talk about reformations as from the perspective of great individuals who led a movement. Well, these people, these parishioners are leading a phenomenal movement. And I just, you know, give them a standing round of applause. I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Well, you know what's going to be fascinating here is the parishioners are refusing to leave. So the archdiocese is now faced with a public relations disaster. Are they going to sneak in at 2 o'clock in the morning and drag people out of there and hoping that the TV cameras aren't going to be there? Because they're clearly, they've said it, they're willing to be arrested. And
didn't the spokesperson, Terry Dolan, say we're not arrested? I mean, maybe that's what you want, but we're not doing it. What's his line?
He says that they want a confrontation. We're not going to give them a confrontation. Well, how are you going to get them out of there then? You know, they're saying they're not going to leave. What do you think, Irene?
Well, I know they would like to pray them away, but they're not going to go away. And I solely, one of the few moments I agree with Emmett, this will just have to.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a new day. I miss
it's
you,
only
Emmett.
Because you're not here,
that's
Emmett.
Right.
That's
I miss
why.
You. They're going to have to really take this as a loss. Really. And yeah. and if anything, a loss financially, but not in terms of the Christian spirit, because really they are exemplars of what it means to be faithful worshipers.
You know, speaking of it's Christian spirit for a second, I have said this ad nauseum and I've never been proven right, but I'm going to say it again, Emmett. If it turns out I was going to call him a politician. I didn't mean that in a pejorative way. If Cardinal O'Malley, a leader in this case, acknowledged after 10 years, not that we want you to leave, but you know what? You have shown your faith so deeply that what we have decided to do is not even sell it to you. We're reassigning a priest to this place, and we're going to welcome you back into the archdiocese. This would be cause of celebration throughout the land, wouldn't it, Emmett Price?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what we're all praying for, Jim, because these folks do not want to leave the Catholic faith. They do not want to, you know, become, you know, the kind of expatriates, if you will, of the Catholic faith. And they are, you know, again, working it out in terms of making sure that they are doing all the rites and all of the, you know, sacraments and whatnot. And they're doing it in a phenomenal way. So I agree with you, Jim. I think that that would be a phenomenal move if it happened.
You know, I love that you mentioned Market Basket, by the way, Emmett Price, too, because this is like Market Basket writ large. 10 years.
Yeah.
By the way, for those who are listening to this who don't know much about it, Marjorie's written about it. I'm sure you, Irene, and you, Emmett, have spoken about it in the past. Imagine anything where they have
years.
To have somebody there every minute of every day
sleeping.
Of every week, or else the church is going to take back the thing, take back the parish.
And not only that, they've had to have priests in cahoots with them who
That's
would
right.
sneak down, you know, in these other places have done these vigils and had these services in church, sneak the consecrated host down because they're not supposed to be cooperating with the enemy, as it were. So it's like this big movement.
It's really a beautiful story.
In churches all over the place.
But it won't have a good ending. See, where Market Basket will come to an end, the church will overwhelmingly.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't think we can have a great moment
absolutely.
Here?
Absolutely.
A come to Jesus moment in the best sense?
Well, you know, it would be good for them to really take that lead and clean up their... They can do a PR cleanup, just as you said. You know, like, you know, I've seen it in my heart to change our position and
can I tell you
open
something?
The church.
No one is a bigger sap for an apology than I am, by the way. Whenever somebody who's a high-ranking person, whether it's in the church or in government, has the courage, or even if it's the strategy, to say, maybe we were wrong.
Yeah, be like,
does that not melt
like
the hearts
Pope,
of all opponents?
Be like Pope Francis
really?
Comes to the Boston Archdiocese.
But what we don't want to see is that we always like to see the devotional side of church. And one of the things that has always been ugly is the business side.
Yeah.
And that side tends to overwhelmingly win.
We're talking with the Reverend Irene Monroe and the Reverend Emmett Price. I want to talk about this whole immigration situation where this weekend there were 100 religious protesters arrested down in front of the White House, and they're protesting, of course. They were complaining about Barack Obama not giving a moral voice, as they put it, to this whole situation of these children and teenagers coming over the border and what's going to happen to them, etc. But I guess I was a little underwhelmed by the numbers. There were 100 arrested and a few more 100 there. This is not exactly a big crowd, Emmett Price.
Is after we talked to both of you about how the faith community was going to lead the immigration
fight.
It was
kind of a pathetic showing by the faith community. Am I wrong?
No, Emmett? I agree with you. You know, I totally agree with you, Marjorie. This was really upsetting. You know, you had, you know, a little bit of north of 100 and, you know, the 100 got arrested and, you know, a couple hours later, you know, minus $50, they were out of jail and, you know, it kind of, you know, blew over. I think we have to be a little bit more strategic in how we organize across the denominations and certainly across the states to get folks together, because I think a lot of people really want to participate. But as always, there's no organization there.
Yeah.
Why don't you agree, Irene?
Irene is back.
Yeah, that's right.
Why don't you agree, Irene Monroe?
Because we would like for the church to say that it takes the high moral ground and that indeed it has the impetus to really change the moral compass. But the truth be told here is that there is Christian xenophobia. And one of the problems here is that that is an issue. We're welcoming as long as they're part of us. They are us. But if they're other, which indeed this is perceived to be, church and church people are no different than any other folks.
Yeah, but wait a second. The head of the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, he's from Seattle, I can't remember his name, referred to this in this emotional line as a low point for our country, and then goes on to excoriate those in Washington who are on what he considers to be the wrong side of history. Yeah. That's a pretty high-ranking voice, is it not?
Yeah, but, the interesting thing is that, he's not an elected official. He has nothing to worry about in terms of his particular church. You also, just like politicians, pastors have to reflect the will of their parishioners. And if their parishioners are saying no go, this was one of the arguments and continued argument that we kind of have in the black church around same-sex marriage. If the parishioner says no, then you're not following the will of the church, so that's the big issue there. They're not interested, and a lot of people are worried about their state budget being bankrupt.
Emma Price, you got anything more to add?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think the issue here is about the moral voice, and let's just imagine that Irene is right here. There are still more than 102 people, who believe that, that
they didn't show up.
I mean, and that's the problem, and that's part
of
planning as opposed to the people. Oh, I certainly wasn't there. I'm further south. You're right.
Yeah. Well, the Catholic bishops did make a statement about this, but it wasn't exactly "let's storm the barricades" kind of thing. It was they're on the side of the humane treatment of the immigrants and so forth and so on. But there wasn't any overall. This poor nun, Sister Eileen Campbell, her little Sisters of Mercy, I guess they showed up in force, but there's not that many of them.
But look, juxtapose that with rank and file Catholics in, where is it, Scituate, we were just talking about, who have kept vigil for 3,650 days, 24/7, and the number of people who are willing to inconvenience themselves to make a statement to the White House.
We just got an email from Christine, who is one of the survivors of the sex abuse crisis. She says, why would anybody assume that the church leaders are going to do the right thing? They don't like to be disobeyed. They'll dig in and remain firm in the position, regardless of the logic or the morality involved. Are we forgetting recent history? Excellent points, Christine.
I think she's talking Scituate, I would bet, rather than...
She was talking Scituate,
now,
yes.
For Emmett Price
But I just want to say that with the children coming across the borders, one of the things we forget, and most of them will be predominantly Catholic, it changes not only the demographics in terms of who will comprise of this Catholic worshiping body, but it also forces one to change the liturgy. And one of the things that we're not talking about is that, again, even though the Catholic Church is welcoming, how welcoming are they? Because the welcoming, Matt, is shown that when the liturgy reflects the demographic change that is present in your church.
What do you mean? Just saying different languages, or having a little bit more fun in the mass?
Emoting. Okay.
We're gonna get to emoting in a second. Yeah.
Speaking of emoting, this is Marjorie's favorite story of the day. Take it away, too. Marjorie.
Well, it is. With all the problems, once again, the Vatican really gets down to the brass tacks here, and they're cracking down on the sign of peace in Mass.
Explain what the sign of peace is.
The sign of peace is where you turn around at a certain point in the Mass and you shake hands, Christ be with you. Well, I guess they're upset about this because apparently people are getting a little, as you would say, Irene, they're emoting a little
bit. They're having too much fun with the sign of peace.
Singing the song of peace, or the priest leaves the altar during Mass to come down and shake hands with the congregation. We can't have that, they said. Or at weddings and funerals, instead of saying peace be with you or Christ peace be with you, they say, congratulations to the bride and groom or condolences to the funerals. I mean, they're cracking down on this. They're calling it ritual abuse, and they want it to stop. Okay, Emmett Price.
I mean, Pat, when you pass the peas, that was my favorite part of the Mass. I mean, that's when you turn to your left and turn to your right and, you know, embrace somebody. And it really showed the Christian love. And, I mean, for the Vatican to kind of, you know, say you guys are having too much fun and you're loving each other too much and, you know, you're showing too much emotion, that's ludicrous.
Well, let me tell you who said it best. This guy, Thomas Rees, is a Vatican expert. He's a commentator for the National Catholic Reporter.
Jesuit.
I love this quote. Is he a Jesuit?
Yes.
He says, it ignores the most ancient tradition where the kiss of peace occurred at the end of the liturgy of the word. He says, I pity the poor priest who has to tell his congregation not to smile during the kiss of peace. How great is that?
And can I elaborate about what the kiss of peace was?
Of course you can.
The kiss of peace was where you literally kissed your parishioner on the lips. But
before
homophobia set in, before homophobia set in, they stopped it. So now, with folks not allowed to shake hands or hug each other, I have a suggestion.
I'm afraid to ask, what is it?
Fist bump. Okay, fist bump.
We're going to get to that, actually, in a few minutes.
But I just want to say this, that it's a shame that he would say this for a number of reasons, that the Catholic Church, the demographic of the Catholic Church, one of the reasons why he is elected is to bring in that Latin American flair. And they will emote and should emote. And it's a collective kind of emoting. So people worship very differently. So my whole idea of him being part of this universality of the Catholic Church, we have to allow different worship styles. This is why I just want to say I worship at a black church because we rock and roll.
It's funny you should mention
Tito, and emote.
Tito Jackson was talking about that. He's a Boston City Council. He was in Nigerian Mass. He said it was 2.5 hours of rock and rolling and singing. And they have, in my church, in the basement, they have a smaller Spanish congregation. But you could hear them if you're at the 12 o'clock Mass. They are, I mean,
that's
the
right.
Music and the singing and the bopping around.
Collective
worship, everything
that's
else.
That's right, and celebration.
And we see like a bunch of, you know, dead bodies upstairs, I mean, barely moving. So there you go. All right, we're done.
All right, thank you.
Irene Monroe is with us every single week. We should say that Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post in Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price, we missed you this week, but we're glad you joined us on the phone, Emmett.
Good to talk to you both.
Emmett is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you both for being here. Okay. Coming up, a little bit off this sign of peace contretemps in the Catholic Church, we're going to ask you, if you're willing to part ways with a handshake? New research says glad-handing is a dirty exchange, one that transmits lots of bacteria. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
With conflict all across the globe, the struggle to protect innocent life.
The norms and laws that have been built up over centuries to defend civilians in war are being lost.
An examination of the Geneva Convention and whether it's time for nations to reaffirm their commitment to protect those most vulnerable. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And Next Generation Children's Centers, proudly partnering with working families for over 20 years. You can visit NGCC's open house Thursday, August 7th at all locations, 4 through 7 p.m. NGCCenters.com. And Mass Eye and Ear, sense life, experience life. When vision problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit MassEyeAndEar.org for more information.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. You know, the study came out last week. I'm aware of that. But the implication will last a lifetime. News that the handshake, shaking someone else's hand, transmits 2 times the bacteria load as other modes of greeting, such as the high five or even healthier, the fist bump. So now that we all know the most hygienic way to engage, can you imagine giving up the handshake for the pound or the high five? Our number is 877-301-8970. There's so many questions attendant to this. Would you feel weird, for example, if you had a job interview and your prospective boss declined to offer you a handshake and instead offered a fist bump? I'm serious about this. And the flip side of that, for those who are saying this is ridiculous, I don't care what the bacteria transfer is, handshake is a handshake, it's going to stay with us forever. Do you not judge in a big time way what you think of someone else by the quality of their handshake and the initial meeting. I don't mean when you've known them for a while. First time you meet, hey, John Doe or Jane Doe, you have your first meeting, you reach out your hand, he or she reaches out their hand. I read a huge amount into what that physical exchange is. You do or you don't.
I do. It's terrible. But there are some people, and I'm so surprised, people that I think the world of, and I've watched their careers, and I know them well, and in some situation I happen to shake their hand, and it's that soft, like they're not really.
And you can never forget it. Is that not true?
Oh, my goodness. And with your kids, don't you always say to your kids,
firm handshake, you look in the eyes.
Very important. Firm handshake is very important. So, yeah, it's terrible. But I do think that there's something wrong with people who can't shake hands firmly.
877-301-8970. By the way, there's a great piece in the New York Times where it says the upside of a wimpy handshake is fewer bacteria are passed from hand to hand. I'm telling you, it is totally true. Marjorie and I have one person in particular we're thinking about who we will mention, who's quite famous.
Horrified.
There is almost not a time that I have an encounter with this person, and I've known this person for years and years, where I do not think about that first handshake. The flip side is when someone does look in the eyes and firmly grasp, whether it's a kid, an adult, whomever it is, an opponent in politics, and they give you a firm handshake, doesn't it right away?
Yes.
Unless they're trying to crush your bones, which is another issue,
that's
too.
Yeah, too much.
So we want to know at 877-301-8970, two things. One, because of the bacteria situation, you're about to switch from handshake to fist bump or high five, which is totally ridiculous. But some of you may, because there are a lot of germaphobes around. And number two, if you are not, or even if you are, does it not say a lot to you what your initial handshake contact is with another human being, whether it's a boss, it's a worker, it's a friend, it's a colleague, whatever it is. I think it is a huge, huge – by the way, I love the handshake. Do you like a handshake?
Yeah, I think we're a bunch of germophobes. I mean, we are so hysterical about germs. It's ridiculous. Everybody running around with their Purell all the time. And they found out that you're better off having some germs on your hands so that it helps you, you know, build up your immunities to those kinds of germs. I think we're hysterical. If you're so worried about a handshake, then go wash your hands.
877-301-8970. You know, now that I've even spoken for 2 minutes on this, I'm thinking of every horrible handshake I can remember that I've ever received.
A lot of them floating around.
It really,
and you're
and
always
you can't
surprised.
Shake the feeling.
Where it's some, it, particularly a powerful,
be careful here, yes.
A powerful man.
Yes.
You're always surprised when a powerful man shakes your hand with that little wimpy fish-like deal, and you just don't look at them the same way again. It's bad when women do it, but it's not quite so bad.
Well, I think I don't agree. I think it is horrible in any case when you get like a half a hand, or which you occasionally get. You get a half a hand, or you get a wimpy kind of thing. And you know what's amazing?
I must say, sometimes when I have a lot in my hands, I've taken someone's with my left hand, which is bad.
But I shake hands with my left hand.
Apologize.
Yeah, but
my
if
left
you do
hand.
It, as long as you do it with some firmness and
feeling. Well, I always have
feeling,
so many things I'm carrying.
Really? Why don't you give an elbow bump then? Maybe that should be your alternative. 877-301-8970. It's all because of this study, and I'm sure you all heard about it last week. It was published in the August issue, which I know you all read, of the American Journal of Infection Control. I have a subscription. That's why I knew about it first. Let's take a few calls here. Peter, you're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call, Peter. Hi.
How you doing? I think it's kind of much ado about nothing, quite frankly. And media picking up studies that show everything is dangerous to your life is just a little bit too much, honest to God. I taught both my boys that you, just like you said, you give them a firm handshake, taught them how to, like, you know, position their hands so they get a good grip and just look somebody in the eye and do it. And I don't think it's something that will ever go away, and you're right. It does leave a good impression.
Oh,
it's huge.
It does.
You know, Peter, I don't know if you ever saw this. Allison King, my colleague at NECN, did a documentary on the first 100 days of Deval Patrick. One of the best scenes, and I can never remember if it made it into the documentary or was in an outtake that she showed me. He's at some high school in the city.
Oh, yeah.
And he walks up to these two kids who are slouching when he walks over to them and say hello. And firmly, respectfully but firmly, he says to these two boys, and I don't even think he knew a camera was on him. He says, when an adult comes over to you, you stand up, you pull your pants up, you shake their hand firmly, and you look them in the eye. And I felt like standing off my couch and cheering. It's exactly right, and you did well by your kids.
Exactly the God's honest truth. And so you're talking about the limp handshake, because I'll give you – I'm actually in healthcare, and I do sales.
Mm-hmm.
So hand washing is absolutely, you know, paramount. You got to do all that stuff. I mean, just walking through a door, for crying out loud. How many people touch a door? You wash your hands frequently, and you try to avoid germs. But the flip side of that is the person, and there's a guy who works for my company who I've known for probably 15 years now. He's the opposite way. This is a guy that's going to, like,
firmly let you know he can crush every bone in your yeah. head.
I know.
And it's like, really, you have to do that. And, but every time you see him, he shakes his hand like, all right, here it comes. And you just you do your best, but you're never going to win. You're just never going to win.
Peter, that was a great call. Thank you. We appreciate it.
So what is that, a mano a mano kind of thing? That I'm my
the bone
hand
crusher?
Is, yeah, the bone crusher.
Now, when you have a person who is fairly active in life, either because they're prominent or because they have a lot of contact, how is it this one person, for example, that we are talking about?
I don't know.
I mean, how is it that nobody in his or her life, whoever this person is, how come no one has ever said to them, you know, there's a point at which you have to change that handshake because it really is leaving a horrible impression?
I don't know. It's a mystery. It's a mystery to have reached the age of 40 years old and not have somebody tell you along the line, your spouse or your parents or your brother or somebody.
How about 20 years old?
I know it. 20 years old even.
It is a huge.
And think about it, all these kids getting out of college. If you go in for a job interview, that really matters. I mean, if someone shakes your hand friendly
as a prospective
and the eye,
employer, you're talking,
yes,
I totally agree.
Yes, you say this kid has got their act together. And if somebody had this little wimpy handshake, you'd think, ugh.
I know.
You know what I mean?
We're in the same
You don't
place.
Want them in the office.
I understand.
It's
that.
Terrible.
You don't want them anywhere near you.
You really
is what
don't.
You're saying.
No. I think they should be shipped to the moon.
Maureen, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Maureen.
Hi. I'm calling about one topic you brought up as far as handshakes during the service.
Sure. Sure. The mass. Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, if you think about the mass, that's the only time that people will turn and extend themselves. You know, most of it is the celebrant up front, you know, controlling the service. And I just think it's a really nice community building gesture. And I would hate to see that because of people concerned about germs. I'd hate to see that particular aspect lost.
Amen, as one might say.
Oh,
I could. Listen, I'm not a Catholic, but I could not agree. Okay, spirituality columnist to be for the Boston Globe.
Well, this is another sort of Vatican misstep. I mean, let's face it. You know, they're not concerned about the – well, they are concerned about the germs because sometimes during flu season they ban the handshake altogether. But they're concerned about people saying Merry Christmas at Christmas Eve Mass instead of Christ be peace of Christ be with you. I mean, it's kind of one of these
Thanks
things. Don't
much.
They have enough to worry –
Maureen, thank you.
Don't they have enough to worry about without cracking down? It is, as Maureen just said. It's a nice moment in the Mass. We turn around and greet people. And it's really nice, especially if you're in a smaller daily Mass, for the priest to get off the altar and come around and shake people's hands.
Great.
Put the kibosh on that as well.
Did you teach your three kids to, like that first caller did?
Yes.
You did?
I did.
I mean, you said to them, firm handshake, look in
There's
the eyes, the whole
than
deal.
Life than the wimpy handshake.
No, it's
won't
huge.
Hire you. Okay, let's go to Anonymous in Boston.
This should be good. Hi, Anonymous.
Hi. Hey, I don't think we're ever going to get rid of the handshake. It is acceptable in all forms and in all situations in society.
Now, why are you anonymous?
Because I'm a restaurant inspector.
Ooh.
And I shake hands with the person in charge when I go into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm back in the kitchen and I meet somebody, I usually bump elbows. And that's kind of a kitchen thing for me that works really well. But as far as handshaking, I shake hands hello, and then I go back in the kitchen and I wash my hands, and then I start the inspection. And I feel like, you know, that's what hand washing sinks and fabulous smelling soap and soft paper towels are for. We don't want to give up social things because there might be germs. I mean, think about what you do with your hands. Well, what do? We wash them. If we sneeze or cough or go to the bathroom, the best thing to do is to wash those hands before you spread your germs onto somebody else.
I bet you're a great inspector.
You
that
know,
was a great call, Anonymous. I mean, thank you.
Sometimes you see people, and I hope that they have an illness or something, but sometimes you see people on the tee with the mask over their face and the gloves on their hands holding the overhead thing. Well, I don't know. Maybe
they
do.
OCD.
Or maybe they're just, you know, Howard Hughes. Or what's his name? Who's the other guy? Donald Trump,
theoretically,
But
they said when he was almost running for president, we discussed this a few years ago, that he actually was shaking people's hands, but it's not his preference. He's not a handshaking kind of guy.
That's another great point.
What's that?
When you're a politician, think how many hands you have to shake. Now, do you see them all dropping like flies out in the parade route? You don't, do you?
No, you don't.
You know why? Because they build up their immunities. It's like when you work in a daycare center. You go to work in a daycare center, which I did when I was young. First couple of days. Your first couple of weeks, you're sick all the time from the babies, but then you build up your immunities, and you're like the iron daycare worker.
Mm.
That was me, Jim.
Well, that's amazing. Let's go to Daniel in Arlington. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, like a lot of the callers, I agree that the handshake is probably not going away as a norm. I think it's too useful as a moment of real intense personal contact with someone. And like you guys mentioned, it tells you a lot about someone. But if we're going to go away from it because of germs, I wouldn't go to, you know, high five or fist bump. Those are too brief. I'd go back to the colonial era when our founding fathers would bow to each other. Things that also tells you a lot about, you know, your social standing and interaction in a useful way.
Do you do that, Daniel?
No, it's not a norm. But if we're going to make a new norm,
and
replace the handshake, I'm gonna put forth bowing.
Well, I'd have to contemplate the bowing thing, but the reason why the handshake, we haven't said this, shouldn't go away, is it's not just a greeting and a statement and something. Physical contact, which we haven't mentioned at all, between two people who are meeting each other or who know each other, who've had a conversation, who are partying, or who are meeting for that particular moment, who know each other. Don't you think that physical contact is hugely important, not just the tradition, but the physicality of it?
No, I agree. I agree that that physical contact is really important. I feel like you can tell a lot about someone through the handshake, and that it's an important way to connect with someone.
See, my worry about the bow is, I'm just worried I couldn't straighten up again afterwards some days. You know, that's the problem, Daniel. But we'll contemplate it. Thank you for the call.
Listen to this email from Rosemary. She says, when I was the mother of the bride, I had occasion to stand at the back of the church and shake hands with a various array of guests. That was 16 years ago, and I still remember who had the weak, limp handshakes, and sometimes I wish I didn't know.
I'm so glad. What's that person's name?
Rosemary.
I'm so glad Rosemary wrote, because it is totally...
Rosemary,
my apologies.
No, it's my fault.
Oh, it never goes away.
I know.
If you see well, she hasn't even seen some of the people, but if you ever see the weak handshake person again and again and again, it's the first thought you have. It leaves an indelible mark. It really does.
You know, this isn't on our topic, but Scott just emailed about the shocking number of men who leave the restroom without washing their hands.
Well, let's not go into that today. Let's not do that. Really, we've had this discussion far too many times. It never ends up in a good place. It really doesn't. How many times have we done it? And as soon as we've done it, every time.
At least 20
times. You know what you say to me afterwards? Every time we do it, you say we really
never
shouldn't
again.
Have done that.
Never right? again.
So never again. Okay. Let that be the case here.
Mary from Arlington, what do you think about handshakes?
Well, my father always called them a fish handshake.
Yes that's right.
If it wasn't good. But so I was always influenced by him. But I had the chance to meet Jake LaMotta once.
The famous fighter.
Yeah. Exactly. And he said, you have a great handshake. And that always resonated with me. And I think that if somebody has a fish handshake, it's almost like they don't think much of you. And I always took it as, you know, sort of a somebody just feeling, you know, not having any feeling towards you, even as a human being. I just think it's so bad.
I love a person who's done this much thinking about the hand. I'm serious.
Right.
What was the name of the great film with Robert De Niro playing Jake LaMotta?
Raging Bull.
What a
Raging
great
Bull.
Movie
that was.
That was
a great movie.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember meeting George
Mary,
Foreman.
Mary, that was a great call. Thanks.
The boxer, George Foreman, one time. And
you shake his hand? I remember you wrote a column.
I don't remember. All I remember is that he had the biggest hands I'd ever seen in my whole life.
You know whose hand I shook at? Logan? Or maybe it was LaGuardia when I lived in New York. The late Andre the Giant. Every finger was like a salami. I mean, for those who don't remember Andre the Giant, former wrestler, and he was in one of the great movies of all time, The Princess Bride. And he was like 7'5", and he died early, which is unfortunate.
Did you shake his hand?
I did shake his hand.
So what was it like?
I just said it was like five salamis.
In closing yours.
On each hand. Okay. I didn't mean that it was strong or weak or whatever. It was the hugest hand ever. Let's go to, I hope it's Marva. I hope I got this right.
Hi,
Cambridge.
Marva.
You're next on Boston Public Radio. Marva, hi.
It's Margo, your friend.
Oh, Margo.
Margo.
As in Margo Howard. How are you, Margo?
He's got a great
I feel very strongly about this, and I am somewhere between Michael Jackson and Howard Hughes.
You are?
I have been saying to people for years, I don't shake hands anymore, but we can kiss.
Now, okay.
Why don't you shake hands, Margo?
Because I get crazy with the Purell. Shake a hand, put on the Purell. Shake a hand. But I will tell you this, and this is a not great admission, but I do shake hands if it would be awkward if I did not. For example, if it were a person of color, I always shake hands.
Because you're afraid that you're going to be seen as blowing them off or something? Is that
right.
the deal?
Yes. So, or if it's a terribly important person, then you shake hands, then you pull out the Purell.
So Margo, what is when you have shaken hands with someone who does have the wimpy fish handshake?
Of course it makes a terrible impression.
Yeah. Do you advise them and tell them to clean up their ways?
Not, no, you'd think I would, but I've never.
No, believe me, we think you would. Now, Margot, don't go away yet. I am guessing, Margot Howard, who obviously is of some fame, to say the least, we were talking about Howard Hughes being the sort of the germaphobe in chief. Do you ever meet Howard Hughes?
No, but I met one of his bodyguards. In fact, that's in my book, and I learned a lot about him. This was at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Tell us.
And every property he owned had guards, and around his person, he certainly had guards.
Mm-hmm.
And I was camped out at the Beverly Hills Hotel for a week, and I would walk by this bungalow, and on the porch would be a man in a suit and a fedora. This is in Southern California. So the Beverly Hills, if you've been there, had this great bar, coffee bar in the basement of the hotel. So one day I was on a stool next to the guy with the fedora and the suit. And I said, "Do you work for who I think you work for?" And he said, "Yes." And I learned some interesting things about the way he operates, and that actually is in my book.
Well,
okay,
Margot,
tell us the name of your book, because we're going to talk to you about it in the fall, but it's one of the great names of all time.
Oh, thank you. The name of the book is Eat, Drink, and Remarry, Confessions of a Serial Wife.
Margot, we really miss you. We are going to have you here in the fall.
We can't
the great
wait.
Margot Howard. Thank you, Margot. We'll
Thanks
talk to you.
Thanks for calling. I'm going to squeeze in one more call.
Eat, Drink, and Remarry. Is
Isn't that great?
That's pretty
Eat,
great.
Drink, and Remarry.
One more quick one.
Anonymous from Cape Cod. What do you think, Anonymous?
Hi, Anonymous.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment on the weak handshake.
Yeah.
I think it's so disappointing when you see a strong, handsome man and you shake his hand and it's weak. And it just makes you think that he'd be such a lazy lover.
Well, that should end this conversation.
Put a little more effort into it.
Put a little more effort into it, she says.
Very good.
Anonymous,
That's
thank you.
That's the perfect
you.
Ending.
Wonder
okay.
why she's anonymous.
Coming up, we're
going to
talk. Maybe she had
well,
a few
whatever.
Guys
Go
that
ahead.
Fit that description. Anyway, coming up, Garen Daly joins us to look at how Catholicism has been portrayed in film over the years in the person of the priest. The latest example of this is the new film, Calvary. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Novelist Karen Ma is Chinese, but she grew up in Japan. She says bad relations between the two countries can get very personal.
My brother-in-law is Japanese, and of course my sister being Chinese, and every time there's a new bout, if you will, between the two countries, they end up in a domestic argument.
Why China and Japan refuse to get along. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and North Shore Music Theater's production of Grease. You can take a trip back to the 50s with the original rock and roll high school musical, playing August 12th to 24th. More information available at nsmt.org.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And the new film, Calvary, it's set in Ireland, takes on clergy abuse in a way that looks at the long-term repercussions it has both on the victim and on the local clergy.
What do you want to say to me? I'm here to listen to whatever you have to say.
I'm going to kill you, Father.
Certainly a startling opening line.
Oof, jeez. Calvary is the latest film in a tradition of movies that have reflected changes within the Catholic Church and society's perception of it. Film critic Garen Daly joins us to look how Hollywood's portrayal of priests over the decades has changed. Garen, it's great to see you.
Hi, you guys.
So, Garen, before we get to how the perceptions have changed over the decades, tell us a little bit more about Calvary.
Well, first of all, it's directed by this guy named John Michael McDonough, whose brother... Neil, I believe, did In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. His other film was called The Guard. So it's a very talented family. He's an expatriate Irishman living in London. And it stars Brendan Gleeson. It's part of a trilogy of suicide that they're calling about, being the first one, The Guard, this one being the second one, Calvary. And that opening scene that we just heard on the radio is the very first scene in the movie.
Takes your breath away. I watched the trailer. It is really dramatic.
It is one of the best films I've seen this year.
It is. Oh, good, because I read two reviews. One loved it and one hated it.
I think it really depends on what your background is.
Okay.
But it's a really what McDonough did was he originally was going to plot the film along the 12 Stations of the Cross. Instead, he couldn't do that because it was too big. He decided to make it on the 5 Stages of Grief by Kubler-Ross. And that's the kind of intelligence you're seeing. And when you do watch it, I highly recommend pay attention to two things. One is the use of color in the film, because it's brilliant. And the second one is there is a mesa in the background. It's part of the landscape in Sligo. And he uses this wonderful baseline going underneath it to give it this kind of pagan feel of like this mountain has seen it before and will see it after you're gone.
That's a beautiful description, Gary.
You know what I love, too, just from the little bit I've seen from the trailer, is all these great scenes of the water and the green in Ireland. It's like that Ryan's Daughter movie a million years ago, all these great vistas.
Right. And again, when you see the film, match that against the interior signs of the bar, which is in red, or the priest's bedroom, which is stark white. So when someone like me looks at a film, you start looking at these things and you don't necessarily notice it, but it has an impact on how you watch the film.
See, when Garen, he says, when someone like him looks at a film, that's how he looks at it. When I look at a film, I say, can I go now to get the popcorn or shall I wait 15 minutes? Now, Garen Daly, let's step back. This is the latest incarnation, for lack of a better expression, of a priest on the silver screen. When we heard we're going to talk about this for you today, Marjorie, what was the first film featuring a priest that came to mind? I'll tell you what mine was without...
First film featuring a priest, The Exorcist.
Oh, really? Okay, and what's the first film you would think of?
I always start from the beginning with Pat O'Brien.
Oh, gosh.
Angels with Dirty Faces.
When priests were all perfect and...
Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, part of it was part of the production code. You could not show a member of the clergy in bad light. So anytime that you showed a priest, a reverend, or any of that stuff, they always had to be in a good light. And then after the code started eroding in the 50s, you started seeing more definitive and more in-depth versions of priests.
Okay, here's my favorite. Okay. We'll play this one first. One of the great movies of all time, On the Waterfront. Activist priest Father Barry, he's rallying longshoremen, this is Carl Malden, against union boss corruption. Listen.
Now what does Christ think of the easy money boys who do none of the work and take all of the gravy? And how does he feel about the fellows who wear $150 suits and diamond rings on your union dues and your kickback money? And how does he, who spoke up without fear against every evil, feel about your silence?
Gives me chills. It really gives it. That was brilliant.
He was terrific.
But there's some backstory to this that's really interesting.
What?
First of all, this is directed by Elia Kazan and written by Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg was a communist in the 30s and renounced it and was a friendly witness at the House of Un-American Activities. And Elia Kazan ratted. So this film is a way of them kind of rationalizing what they had done. In the meantime, the other level of it is that Carl Malden, as Father Barry, is the first priest who is on the street working things with the people. Before that, they
first
may have
in
been,
film, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying in a gritty way.
Really?
When you go back to Angels with Dirty Faces, Father O'Brien's on the street, but it's all this really nice Irish lilting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm with you. I'm with the boys. I'm your friend forever. He's getting down and being nitty gritty. This is a change in how priests were actually depicted in Hollywood.
So I was thinking this morning before I read some of the material about why have priests been center stage, literally and figuratively, for so long. And when I read something, it makes so much sense. Is right away the collar. The since it's a visual medium, having the collar, whether they represent good or evil in a particular piece of work, sets the stage. I mean, that is what it is it not?
It's one of the things, especially when
what else is it?
Well, there's also something about Catholic mysticism. And when you're talking about, you know, The Exorcist, a perfect example of that.
It's so scary.
It's not only scary, but it's also, if you take a look at the two priests, Father Marin and Father Karras, they are two kind of distinct people. Father Marin, who's played by Max van Sydow, is very firm in his belief. Father Karras is a little wishy-washy, and only through the exorcism and all that thing, all those, you know, that evil, is he able to really reaffirm his faith in God.
Remember that
Here it
scary
is.
Soundtrack?
The whole thing was scary. Oh. Here's the, in the extras, young priest Father Karras, who Garen was just talking about, is tortured over being absent at the death of his mother. Here, another priest consoles him and ultimately puts him to bed. Listen.
Oh, Christ. I should have been there. I wasn't there. I should have been there.
There was nothing you could do. Lie down.
Give me the button. Anything against sleep?
Yeah. Are you going to steal my shoes now?
No. I tell fortunes by reading the creases. Now shut up and go to sleep.
Another pretty good scene.
good dialogue.
Tubular Bells, that's what it was
Tubular
called.
Bells. Yeah. Michael Oldfield.
Oh, my God, gave me the creeps.
But again, this is a film that spawned all the other kind of horror as Catholic priests. I mean, there's a film called Priests from like 2010 where, you know, it's an archangel coming down to save the earth in a post-apocalyptic thing. There are priests in almost all the horror films that you see these days because they're the ones that seem to be in touch with that evil side of things because it's black and white, going back to your description of their costumes. So,
and they had something that I didn't even know about, this 1999 film, Priest, about this gay priest. We have some sound from that as well, too. This is where the homosexual priest, Father Greg Pilkington, describes how tortured he feels whenever he looks at a crucifix.
I sit in my room sweating. I turn to him for help. I see a naked man, utterly desirable. I turn to him for help, and he just makes it worse. Now, up there in my room, that's my Gethsemane. I understand humanity then, every sin, every compulsion. I understand it all.
Who's that, Garen?
That was Linus Roche, Tom Wilkerson, and Robert Carlyle in this film, directed by Antonio Bird. And a quick little personal anecdote. I played that film when I was running the Dedham Community Theater, and I was outed on the St. Mary's pulpit and had everyone call me up at home and tell me that what a bad person I was for showing this film, even though no one had even seen it.
So, you're kidding.
Oh, no, that happens all the time.
And,
but,
wow.
But as an exhibitor, what you do is you immediately send out a press release.
And saying what?
I'm being picketed.
Oh, and that gets everybody.
And it drives business. I mean, it's amazing. But, you know, what this film is this is a film where you have the priest very conflicted about his own mortality and what he's doing. He's attracted to men. He goes to gay bars. In the confessional, he hears about abuse from that one of his parishioners is doing on his young daughter. And it's really kind of nasty. But he can't break the confessional vow and tell anybody, so he has to resort to prayer. So even though this is a film that looks at a gay priest trying to deal with his own failings as a human being, that ultimately it is a film about how it is redeeming, that prayer works. So it's very conservative in that matter.
We're talking to Garen Daly about priests in film through the years. So is it a safe assumption? This may be so pathetic to even ask, but I will anyway. Are priests on the screen a reflection of how they are viewed in society at large?
Yes.
I mean, I'm assuming that the role of the priest on the screen has changed dramatically since a decade or so ago when we had the disclosure of this horror show in this archdiocese and then around the world.
And that is exactly what Calvary is all about. It is about how this really good-natured priest, who was married and has a daughter and went into the priesthood afterwards, how he deals with all these people, all these sinners, all these different kinds of people who see him differently, and most of it in a negative manner.
Yeah.
And how he navigates this with a great deal of dignity and grace and humor, because it's Brendan Gleeson, and he's so good at it. It is, for those who are real films of cinema, it's not unlike Robert Bresson's 1951 film, Diary of a Country Priest, which had a young priest going around to this French village, and they hated him. But this is a different thing, because in Brendan Gleeson, you find someone that you really, really like.
This is a contemporary Ireland, correct?
It's contemporary Ireland.
So, and where the sex abuse crisis has just been absolutely horrible, and some of the people from what I read in the film are just the heck with this whole church because of this mess that we've all gone through here, and they're all doing cocaine in the pubs and the bathroom and stuff like that.
Right, and they're flaunting it. But I had a chance to interview Brendan Gleeson about his role, and there are two things. If we have time, I'd like to bring it up. First one is that he talked about the current situation of priests in Ireland and how they have been minimized by these scandals and by the corruption that, that went in with the bureaucracy. And he made a very good
point. You mean the innocent ones? Is that what he means?
Even everyone is being minimized. The priests, there's no longer a lot of attendance at the churches. There are, you know, the role of the priest in traditional Irish villages was extremely strong. That has been minimized as well. But he makes a good point in saying that there's still a lot of births and marriages and deaths that priests officiate, and the church at this point in Ireland is trying to determine whether they should start running a harder tact with people who don't go to church regularly and yet still want to have a church wedding.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing. The other thing is there's a scene in the movie where the film tips. There's always a tipping point in a movie where everything in the film kind of just changes or goes darker, goes lighter, whatever. This scene is when Brendan Gleeson as the father meets a serial killer and cannibal named Freddie Joyce, who's played by his son Donald Gleeson. And the story that Brendan told me was neither one of them really knew what the other one was going to do, but neither one gave an inch. So it is one of the best scenes you're going to see, because here's a father and son going at each other in the context of this movie and being consummate actors.
Can we go back to happier days, Darren
Daly? Yeah,
so I'm not sure if this is
cannibals.
Right. You know, I may get one of these actors wrong, but when I was a kid, when I was a really young kid, I think I thought that Spencer Tracy, Bing Crosby, and Pat O'Brien were all priests.
They were.
Now, first of all, let's do a little sound with Bing Crosby. What movie is this from where he plays Father O'Malley?
Well, he played in two. I'm not sure if this is from either Going My Way or Bells of St. Mary's.
Okay, so some young, struggling student, Patsy, has a crisis of confidence, and Father O'Malley, this is Bing Crosby, reminds her of the joys of being alive.
Here glad you're alive. To be grateful because people are kind to you. To be able to see some of nature's great wonders, the budding of the flowers in spring, and to be able to appreciate beautiful music, and to be conscious of the beauty of tasting and feeling and hearing only the things that are good for you, to be aware of why you're here. I can go on and on and on.
I could go on and on, but I have to go home and punch out my
exactly.
own sons.
I know.
Bing Crosby abused
terrible.
This show. I shouldn't have made a joke about it. But so he made Crosby played Father O'Malley twice. Is that what he said?
Correct.
And
won Oscars.
He did?
Yeah.
For both?
No, just one of them.
And Spencer Tracy and Pat O'Brien. I'm right about them, too.
Right, Spencer Tracy. Boys Town is Spencer Tracy. Also, one of my favorite schlocky films is San Francisco.
I don't
with
think
Spencer,
I ever saw it.
Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, and Jeanette McDonald.
Oh, my goodness.
It's about the earthquake, but Spencer Tracy plays a priest. Clark Gable plays the roguish gambler. Jeanette McDonald plays the love interest, and they all survive the earthquake, so it ends up in happy.
You know, we're getting an email from Sheila about a more contemporary film, 2008, that Seymour Hoffman,
Doubt.
That just died, played the priest in Doubt, which, of course, he did.
Right.
Yeah. And that was a great thing about not being sure whether this priest was guilty or not of abusing a child. And this nun, I think Meryl Streep
was in it. And Amy Adams.
And Amy Adams, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And he was fantastic.
It was a good film. John Patrick Shanley, I believe, wrote the play, and he also directed the movie as well. And it's you don't really know whether or not something really did happen.
Yes.
But you can see with that film that doubt has crept in. It's no longer that these priests are infallible or that they are the paragons of virtue. They are very much human and subject to human foibles.
In fact, we happen to have a bite from that, a clip from that, too. In this clip, Sister Aloysius, who, and it is Meryl Streep, confronts Father Flynn, Philip Seymour Hoffman, about his shady history. Here it is.
You have no right to go rummaging through my past.
You have a history. This is your third parish in 5 years.
Call the pastor. Ask him why I left. It's perfectly innocent.
I'm not calling the pastor.
Now, I'm a good priest.
Go after another child. I had another child until you are stopped.
What nun did you speak to?
I won't say.
I've not touched a
you
child!
Have!
It is a great movie. Do you like that movie?
I do like that movie. And again, because think about it. You get two really good actors doing some really good dialogue. So you got Philip Seymour Hoffman and Meryl Streep. I mean, Amy Adams, I think, was a little too light for the role, but that's okay.
And I think, as you said it before, at the end, you really didn't know if he did it or not. Wasn't that the ending?
But
did you know?
I think we all assumed
he did.
That he did.
Yeah.
Because that's really what the, I think was. But again, at that point, you really couldn't go out and say that the priests were pedophiles.
Well, you know, remember during the whole height of the sex abuse crisis here, you would hear a lot of priests say they were not wearing the collars when they went out.
I remember
you
writing about that.
They were all wearing regular, button-down shirts and sweaters because of the abuse that they were taking, whether they'd done anything wrong or not. It was kind of sad.
Okay, so, Garen, we're going to get to the portion of our discussion, which you hate every single time I bring it up, so I'm doing it one more time.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Tell us three movies. If people say after hearing this, this is how I feel every time I talk to you, I got to go watch these movies. From different sort of approaches to priests, give them three priestly movies they should go see.
I think you should start off with I Confess. It's an Alfred Hitchcock film with Montgomery Clift.
Oh, someone knew about that. That. It was great.
See, I had to find one that you had to see.
Great.
Where he hears about a murder in the confessional and he has to deal with that. That's a really good one. If you want to go back and see those wonderful days of priests back in the 30s, Angels with Dirty Faces, and for a variety of reasons, not only is Patrick O'Brien very good in it, but when you watch the beginning of it, think of Casablanca, because it was one of those Warner Brothers films directed by the same director, and you can see that the music and the setup is exactly the same. And then I would probably go for something a little more edgy and over the top, and that would be Dogma by Kevin Smith with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and Linda Fiorentino. It's a kind of nasty retelling of the Virgin Mary story.
And the Hitchcock thing is I Confess. I'm going
to
watch it tonight. It sounds great.
Garen Daly, thank you for being here. As always, Garen Daly is a film critic and the producer of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got Open Mic with Harvard Business School's Nancy King. We've got National News with CNN's John King. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, and our engineer, John Parker, and our intern, Devin Karamblis. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you for listening, and please listen again tomorrow. Bye.